Deezer Originals.
Wherever you are, whenever you are, welcome to Talk Stew. My name is Reggie Yates, and I'm pretty fortunate to have a good old group of mates. Now, when I say fortunate, well, I don't know, they're kind of a burden really a lot of the time, but really we have some pretty interesting conversations, so much so that I've decided to share them with you in the shape of this podcast. Why Talk Stew? Well, I like to think that everybody brings a different ingredient to the conversational gumbo. And today, the gumbo is made up of these clowns. First of all, currently chomping away on a Ritz cracker. Trying to do it off mic quite unsuccessfully. And his mouth is full.
I'm leaning away.
Owen Cutts, aka GQ Man of the Year.
Hi.
Are you going to work through that Ritz cracker during your intro?
Sure, yeah.
It's a part of it now. We've got no choice.
How did we actually meet? To give some context on how I know you and why you're here.
We've got a friend called Leon.
Right.
He used to sort of work with you, I think.
A cameraman. I met Leon at Top of the Pops. That's right.
The myth. Yeah. Leon Henry.
Yes. So through Leon, we met. Oh, this is going to sound really weird. I was just checking myself there because I was about to say, through Leon, we met on Hamster Teeth, which is actually true.
It's true. It's true.
But it was during the daytime.
No, it wasn't. It was nighttime and it was at that point.
It was in a bush.
No, it was daytime picnic. Leon used to organise sports days and picnics.
When you say sports days and picnics, is that euphemisms?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Dark.
There were lots of sports in the water.
Car meetups.
Anyhow, we were playing rounders. We did all of that in Hampstead Heath years ago. And now we're mates, I guess.
Are we? What do you mean, I guess?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how much I like you. I'm going to decide by the end of this, I think.
Oh, wow. I didn't know this was like a trial. Am I on trial?
It pretty much is. Okay. Right. Before we get into any more weird stuff about how we met and when we met, it's a bit of a weird question, but I think as people are getting to know you through this, it'd be quite nice if you can sort of give them a bit of a take on maybe how you see the world, I guess. How would you boil it down? What's your sort of perspective on things?
Well, my perspective has just completely changed because I've just had a baby boy who's not a baby anymore, but he's 1.5.
So is everything through the filter of dad now and of provider?
Well, not so. What happened with me was, I can't speak for every dad, but I just completely just didn't give a shit about anything else, really. Like, I didn't care if you liked me or if you thought what I was wearing was good or...
Can I interrupt, Owen, just for a second to say, Owen, before we started this, said that sometimes when he's a bit nervous, he goes a bit more Cockney.
Am I going
He's gone like 10 times more Cockney.
No!
Honestly, he sounded basically like a PG Woodhouse character before we began this. And now he's like, yeah, man, well, I'm just a dad.
Damn it.
But
I need to be called out. I didn't mean to embarrass you because I've been known to do that too. I go so Cockney when I'm around newish
people.
It's
fine, because I am in need of a chimney sweep.
But where am I now? What level am I at now?
You so are in need of a chimney sweep.
I really am. We should probably give that some context because this is the first official episode and we are recording in my house, which isn't actually a house at the moment. It's currently a building site and we're sat in what will become my library. So at the moment, there's literally sawdust on the floor. I don't actually have a floor and there are windows that are about to fall out and be replaced. This is kind of fucking ramshackle. So thank you for not judging me, guys.
I've got claims direct on speed dial.
Okay, good.
Also, when I arrived, the thing I most wanted to do was go to the toilet. I mean, and I had been told we were coming to a house. And you know what? They normally have them. That's what I find, right? Like, I arrive, and you're very nice people who set up your podcast, who said, no, there's no toilet. There's no fucking toilet. So I have gone to the toilet, ladies and gentlemen. This is David Baddiel speaking, by the way, if anyone's wondering. I've gone to the toilet, but that we may be there for another, what?
Yeah.
Who knows? 5 weeks, 6 weeks?
By the time I move in. Yeah. I don't know. That we might be there forever. Yeah. It's kind of a fabled week. Yeah. Anyway, just to finish off, this suddenly gone back to Hampstead Heath. Just to finish off Owen for a second in front of everyone. How would you boil it down then? You see the world through the perspective of being a dad and not really giving a shit anymore. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not giving a shit anymore. I mean, like, I don't care about myself, really.
Right.
Like, all that kind of fell away when I had my son and I've been a lot sort of like happier from it, I guess.
Right.
Like, I don't care so much about all the stupid little things I did care about. Fair I just care about him and my wife and my family, I guess. Am I Cockney? Am I gone really Cockney?
No, you're not Cockney. You've no, okay, not clean, stolen bit. The heart of everybody listening. That's yeah. what you've done.
What a wanker. Can I ask, are you GQ Man of the Year, or is that just something you said?
That's no, see, this is the thing. This speaks to who Owen formerly was.
Okay.
Owen Cutts used to be the guy who would always have on a new coat, a new pair of glasses,
yeah.
a new pair of shoes. So I started calling him GQ Man of the Year.
I've never actually been.
Oh, you've actually been GQ Man of the Year? Because I'm not really but part of that world.
He's not even been longlisted.
So you were like a fashion icon of sorts.
Well, still am, really. Northwest David, London. If I'm honest.
Okay, so Dave sort of semi-introduced himself.
I have introduced myself. I'm
we'll
sorry.
We'll get to Dave in a minute. That's absolutely fine, because I should probably introduce my other sort of semi-guest, if you will. I don't quite know how to frame you.
Well, just anything you like.
Semi-guest.
You know, when you say semi,
yeah.
Are the pants a bit tight?
No. Okay. When I say semi, I'm referring to the fact that you're, well, we're friends. Yeah. I've known you a long time. Yeah. And David and I are friends, but I've known yeah. you a lot longer.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I refer to you as like the Black Milk Tray Man. But I'm sure you can give it a much better description.
I pretend to hate that.
Right, okay. But,
oh, stop it.
There's a part of you that really does love it.
Deep
now, down. Apparently you're a photographer.
Yep.
But I've never really believed that.
Yep.
So can you tell us a bit more about yourself, Ouz?
I do take pictures for a living.
Right.
Whether you believe it or not. I've taken your picture.
You have?
It was a terrible shoot.
It was a horrible shoot.
None of your fault.
Yeah, we won't speak about that. It was dreadful. But anyway, outside of that,
I look
horrible...
at the pictures every day, by the way.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, so I take pictures, mainly fashion, beauty, advertising. I write scripts now, short films, shoot TV commercials, and myself naked.
Award-winning filmmaker.
Yeah.
You shoot yourself naked, or you just are naked sometimes?
I'm naked and I shoot.
All right.
If you know what I'm saying.
I know what you're talking about.
Wow, that's a horrible metal picture. All right, so Owen's sort of spelled out the way that he'll probably attack half the things that we talked through today. How would you sort of boil down how you see things, how you see the world? What's Ouzo's POV?
It's a tough one. And so I think the world is an amazing opportunity to experience life. I think that you've got to challenge yourself to see different things. And if you live in a city, I think you have to schedule those things in.
Yeah.
I'm all about that.
Scheduling?
Yeah, literally scheduling. Like if you know what you love,
yeah.
actually put it in the diary.
Oh,
because
right.
if not, business is going to do it for you.
Yeah.
You know?
So you about, schedule fun.
Yeah, literally. I've got a list of things I like to do.
When's fun today? What time are you having fun?
This is part of it, I think.
Oh, this is fun?
I don't know. Let's find out.
It's not.
Weirdly, I was supposed to... I'm shooting at 2.
So you may or may not turn up to the shoot.
I'm genuinely... I was like, I'm not missing this because it's too much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
This is the fun.
This is... Yeah, this is... Oh, but, you know, yeah, Richard's going to give me, nice. You know... £20, he
cheers,
said. Mate. So, you know, there's that as well.
Thanks, buddy. Cheers for making it fun.
Brilliant.
All right, and no offense to both of you, I should probably say this because you've already heard him. He's sort of already semi introduced himself.
You've started talking, haven't I?
Yeah.
I did think for a while, he hasn't introduced me. Am I allowed to start talking? And then what happened is I thought of something to say and I couldn't stop myself.
Right.
And as you know, you better introduce me, hadn't you?
Yeah, exactly. I was just like, you're doing it again.
Yeah,
it's fine. I'll live with it. He's a very talkative special guest, if you will. Screenwriter, one of the leading names in British broadcasting, Mr. David Baddiel, is here. Hello, David.
Hello, Reggie. What I was going to say was, if you were going to ask me, which you may or may not have been about to, what about my worldview? Were you about to ask me that?
Yeah, I was. I was going to get to it, but right. Yeah, go for it.
What I was thinking about how... I've sort of acted it out a bit, which is that I find it very difficult not to say what I feel almost all the time. And that's probably been, but I've managed to monetize that in my yeah. life, yeah. really. Because yeah. you mentioned a show I used to do called Unplanned. You know, I used to do that at the end of the 90s, at the start of this century. And that show was just me and Frank Skinner sitting on a sofa.
Chatting,
but also just saying essentially the first thing that came into our heads.
Yeah.
And that's the thing I'm good at that, because I find it very difficult not to say exactly what's in my head. And the value of that, apart from the fact that sometimes it's funny, is that if I have a worldview, it's based on one thing and one thing alone, and that is truth.
Mm-hmm.
I try all the time, and I'm sort of obsessed with this, to try and be as truthful to myself as I possibly can be. And that can mean saying stuff that isn't great, but if it's true to me, I'm going to say it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you came and saw my show, for example. I did a stand-up show recently that was about my family, and it involved a lot of washing of what a lot of people would consider to be dirty linen in public, and you're not meant to do that or whatever, or British people, you know what I mean? But I felt, no, I'm going to talk about it because it's very much part of me and my history.
And it was incredibly brave for
Thank you
to do that and for you to do it the way that you did.
But can I contradict you there, Reggie? Because I actually don't think it's brave. I mean, some people do think it's brave. Yeah. It's very nice of you to say that, but... What I'm talking about is almost like I have a compulsion to speak about this shit. You know, it's like more like a disorder than bravery.
Wait, you know. Have you got kids?
I have 2 kids, yeah.
How do you find there's times when you have to lie to kids.
Yeah.
How do you
I find
that
really
that?
Difficult. Difficult. This is a genuine true thing about me. I find it almost impossible to lie. Right. And with children, I found that difficult.
Yeah.
Like the whole Santa shit.
That what, did you, really what did you do with like difficult. Santa, the Tooth Fairy, and all of those other
well,
things that kids
Morwenna,
care about?
My wife.
Yeah.
She loves all that. I mean, I quite like it. I got no problem with it as an aesthetic, fairies and Santa, whatever. But obviously, I know they don't exist. And so it's been quite difficult because she likes to do things like at Christmas, we have a plate and on the plate is a mince pie and a bit of sherry near the fireplace. And I have to eat a bit of that. So it looks like Santa's had
some. Do you do the footprints?
Yeah, we've done footprints. We've done all that.
Right.
And I'll be honest with you, in the morning, I mean, much more so now that they're older, but even when they were sort of two, and then they think Santa's come, a tiny part of me wants to say, he hasn't come!
Do you think that you'll do that with your boy?
Well, I was going to ask David like, whether it's a compulsion to tell them it's not true, or just when they ask,
yes.
not be right. able to yes. lie.
Well, that's a really key thing. I mean, there's a movie, actually, by Ricky Gervais that you may have seen called...
Something about lying?
The Other Side of Lying. Other Side of Lying?
Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, but in that film, people are constantly... It's very funny. People are constantly just saying stuff that is you're not meant to say. Like, I think there's one point where Jennifer Garner opens the door and says, oh, sorry, I look like this. I've just been masturbating. And it's funny, but I don't quite have that. Yeah. I mean, I have a bit of that. Yeah, but it's more like if someone asks me a question, I can't stop myself from telling them the truth. I really can't.
Well, that's great, though, I think.
Yeah, as someone who doesn't have children, that's, I think, the way that I'd like to think our parent. But you never really know until you have kids yourself, of course. Like, we were a pair of idiots trying to pick up girls in bars, which feels like, I mean, it feels like we were doing that all of 5 minutes ago. Now you're married with kids yourself. So true. I'm sure, like, your thought process on all of that has changed dramatically since Buddy came
picking
along.
Up girls or...
We should probably move on. As part of your intro, I was going to talk a little bit about how we met and also what you've done, because you've done a lot. We met very recently, so I'd kind of call you one of my newer friends, because most of my mates I've known
for...
Yeah, exactly. Most of my mates I've known for like over a decade, like these guys. Yeah. But we met in Uganda as part of this comic relief thing. Kenya and Uganda. We met on the road. As part of this comic relief road trip thing that we did recently. And I was quite honest with you and said that, you know, you came into my life around the fantasy football years, which is where I think a lot of people our age discovered you. Mm. But I had no idea how much of a history there was prior to that.
You had no idea how old I actually
that's
was.
That's basically what I was trying to say. Yeah. You're fucking ancient.
I am. I
had no idea.
I'm 50 fucking three is what I am. But I have done a lot of stuff. Yeah, before that, because you were, if I could use this word, you're quite a big fan.
Yeah,
which, very, very nice. But it's interesting that you didn't really know that before fantasy football, I was in this thing called the Mary White's Experience, and me and Rob Newman, who were the sort of... bloke I work with mainly on that, we were the first comedians to play Wembley Arena.
Right.
And what you find is as you grow older and you're doing stuff, you know, in the public arena, I can't think of another word, I was going to say in showbiz, it sounds so shit. But anyway, that people know about is that you change all the time. The show that I did before the first show about my family was about fame. Mm. And what it was about was about, you know, how weird it is, really, to be more visible than other people and how to have your identity out there and how that changes all the time, right? Mm. How... What the you that is you is not the you that people think that you people are. And actually, in terms of kids, I write children's books now.
Yeah.
So kids of eight come up to me and they think I'm the person who wrote The Parent Agency, which is really lovely. But I also think, oh God, the parents are looking at me like saying, please don't do any of your normal stuff. Because I know what you're really like.
But their relationship with you starts at the books, which over the course of a career, is that something you're thankful for? Is it something you find quite weird? I haven't quite got your head around now that there are different people who see you and know you for very different things.
Yeah, it's weird. I quite like it,
to
be honest, because I think one of the things about truth is that the truth is always complex, and the truth of people is the most complex one of all, right? But fame, as I'm sure you know, wants to not have that. Fame wants you just to be, you know, in my case, the football bloke or whatever, or in your case, the bloke who was on Top of the Pops or whatever it might be.
Mm.
And that's absolutely not true. It's completely not true about you. You know, you've gone on to make these incredible documentaries, but there will be some people who just think of you as that bloke who was on Top of the Pops.
Yeah,
just as there are people out there who think I'm just a bloke who did Three Lines. That's fine, but you know it's not true about you because the truth is always complicated.
Yeah, completely. One of the things that I've found in just looking you up a little bit prior to this was that you wrote a couple of episodes of Spitting Image.
I just wrote sketches on Skin Image. I didn't write whole episodes.
Claim it. No one will be able to check. Just claim the whole thing. Yeah.
No, I wrote. But when I started, I was writing sketches for all stuff, for anything that was on, really, just trying to earn a living.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have any money, and I was doing stand-up. I did quite a lot of stand-up around here, actually. There's lots of places. There's a place called The Venue down the road.
New Cross.
That was the first time I did a big place with Rob Newman, and I was amazed because I've been doing comedy on the circuit for sort of 5 years and just doing the comedy store and really having to sort of fight for any kind of visibility. And then we had one series on TV of that show, The Mary White's Experience, and The Venue down the road from here sold out, and there's 900 people queuing around the block. And it was incredible. It was like a whole... It didn't occur to me, really. Even though I was on telly, it didn't occur to me that it would have that actual impact.
Yeah.
But yeah, sorry, I was doing lots of stuff.
The loudest fly in South London has just come in. Is it a bee?
It's actually I was going to say,
the mic's probably picking up.
Isn't that ridiculous? I think it's a wasp.
It's the last
bee. It's the last bee. It's actually the last bee, and it's so lost because there's one thing that's not in here is flowers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's the last bee. David, you touched on one of the biggest sort of headlines, if you will, in terms of my relationship with you and Frank as a fan. And that was, of course, the Three Lions moment, which I imagine at the time must have been incredible fun. But after that happened, did you sort of resent it, for want of a better word? Because that was the thing that everybody sort of referred to. You know, it was a number one record. It was Euro 96?
Euro 96 was the first one.
Yeah, it was a huge, huge thing. Mm. And for millions of people across the country, you were the Three Lions guys. But at the same time, obviously, you were a writer. You had this huge history.
Was there ever
any resentment towards that success?
No, not really. No. The thing about Three Lions in particular, sometimes people do ask me, well, what do you think you'd be remembered for? And I just say, because I've got the truth thing, Three Lions. And Three Lions might not be the thing that I think I put most effort into or whatever.
Right.
But, and it might not be my, you know, I've written novels and all the rest of it and films. But Three Lions was absolutely fucking incredible. Mm. You know, and not just because of the thing itself. What happened to it, the history of it, was extraordinary, because suddenly we wrote this song and it did manage to capture a moment in time and an attitude towards the England team, which hadn't been done before. Because I think the key element of Three Lions, apart from the brilliant music, which we didn't write, that was Ian Brodie, but the lyrics were about vulnerability. That's the point about Three Lions. Before that, every single England song had been "We're Gonna Win."
Yeah, World in Motion was the last big one.
Yeah, World in Motion, but the World in Motion, which is a brilliant song, is not really a football song, in my opinion. I mean, this is John Barnes rap, which perhaps we should leave out.
That's the best bit of it. What are you talking about?
Okay, you like the John Barnes rap.
are you saying you don't like the John Barnes rap?
Hey, I feel I'm not qualified to judge the John Barnes rap for a lot of reasons, but World in Motion itself, Love's Got the World in Motion. It's not... Our song's got lyrics about Gary Lineker in them. You know, it's a football song. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So I compare it more to the previous England songs, like This Time More Than Any Other Time. And I don't know if you know those songs, like from the 80s or whatever. Right. They were always "We're Going to Win." And when I was growing up, it was clear that wasn't true. So what Three Lions is a song about, we'll probably fuck it up, won't we? Like we always do. But nonetheless, we hope we might not. It's a kind of hope against experience thing. And then what happened was, England, Scotland, 1996, if I could take you back briefly. We weren't playing very well. It was the second game of that tournament. And then in the second half, Gary McAllister missed a penalty. The ball was knocked over the other end. Gazza scored an incredible goal. We won 2-1. The sun came out. And then the DJ, to whom I will be eternally grateful at Wembley Stadium, because he told me afterwards that the FA had said, don't play this song, it's too partisan. Mm. Right? He put it on, and the whole crowd, 80,000 people, all knew the words.
Amazing.
Which I didn't know they did. Like, just to be there and think, well, everyone here knows these lyrics. That's amazing. And joined in. And it's hard to think of a moment, you know, I'm going to mention the birth of my children because you kind of have to. You kind of have to, don't you? Sure, but it's hard to think of a moment in my life.
Mate, stop there, because you're just walking down a very dangerous path here.
The birth of my children was absolutely amazing.
It's gone all cockney.
I've gone cockney to try and get me past this bump. Anyway, it was really amazing.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying.
I've got to say, you're not completely alone. I think Gazza's goal was probably better than Birth of My Child.
It was also one of the best celebrations, because that was when he laid down and they squirted.
But I've got to say something. I'm glad that Three Lions has been brought up, because I was too young, really, for 1990. I pretended for years that I remembered it, but I don't remember watching it.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
I don't remember that. 94, we weren't in it.
No.
So 96 was the first big tournament, it was in England, that I was completely was sorted by.
How old were you?
I was 13.
Right.
And Free Lions, the song, was like what you said, it just completely wrapped it all up in this.
Well, there's something else interesting about Three Lions, what it did, which someone was talking about the other day in some interview I did, and they were talking about, you know, the fact that people at that time, if you watch footage of it, singing, they are waving flags, the Cross of St. George flag. Mm. And there was this brief moment when that happened, when it seemed you could be patriotic about being English without being aggressive, nationalistic and racist.
Yeah, for a second.
Yeah. And I agree. If I'm proud of anything, it's partly that, because I think the song has something to do with that.
But that's the self-deprecating aspect of the song. Probably.
Exactly, yeah.
And that was the summer where those, do you remember, every car had an England flag on it. There was those weird flags that you could buy from petrol station that you had in your window.
In the window.
Yeah, and it would sort of stick out the side of the car. Yeah. And it was that summer that did that.
Yeah.
And they stuck around for a few more summers, and then it just sort of
then
went
away.
Then
you got scared of them again.
Yeah, but then,
when they pulled out, he's like, I'm out of here. I'm gone. But they ain't playing Free Lions, I'm out of here.
But that's so true, though, because, you know, now I think of the Cross St. George flag as that. Do you remember when Emily Thornberry, that Labour MP, she got into trouble because she posted a picture of a Cross St. George flag on someone's house, a window of someone's house.
Right.
And she said something like, it was a UKIP reference. I can't actually remember the reference. Right. And then she got into trouble because of the implication that she was saying something snobbery about. But I thought, well, no, unfortunately, that flag now has got dragged into the thing where you just think it's to do with UKIP, basically.
Yeah.
And that's a pity, because there is a way of being English that we probably should all think about. I'm Jewish. My mum's a refugee from Nazism or whatever. I'm not in any way. My dad's Welsh, but I feel overall English.
Yeah.
If I had to say what am I overall, it would still be English.
Yeah. Right?
But it's very hard to be proud of that, because, you know, the implications and the associations.
It's a very different landscape now, isn't it? It's a difficult one to sort of navigate, particularly when it comes to that. Anyhow, this has been an epic intro. We haven't even started yet. But I'm thankful for it. We've covered some good stuff.
Yeah.
I always feel kind of reticent to refer to you or whoever's in that chair as the special guest. Sorry, guys, but technically you kind of are, and you're steering.
I've also put it in my contract.
That's how I want
he's
to refer
special.
The special one.
So, David,
as
you are technically our special guest, I figure the best place to start is with you and with one of your most recent and current projects that I am absolutely in love with, and that is My Family, Not the Sitcom, which is your one-man show.
Yeah.
Now, for anybody who hasn't been to see it or isn't aware of it, could you sort of explain what the show is and what it covers?
Yeah, it's a show about my mum and dad primarily, although other members of my family come into it. But my mum died a couple of years ago. My dad has dementia. And the show really is a kind of, you know, autobiography, but of what it was like growing up with them, taking those aspects that you don't normally talk about. So one of the things that I talk about a lot is the fact that my mum had an affair with a golfing memorabilia salesman. And the key element of that is that she transformed our life over to golf. Golf became a massive issue in our house. Like she set up a business selling, and that bee is about to fucking sting
it. Don't kill it.
It might be my mum's ghost. But it was really,
now I feel bad,
it was really coming
it
from me then. Yeah, she basically set up a business selling golfing memorabilia, which is what this bloke who she was having an affair also did. And I've always thought it must have pissed him off quite a lot. The bee is still coming for me.
It's really loud as well.
It's so loud.
It's so loud.
Your right hand is now. Oh, he's just going to use
it's off.
There she goes.
Go. Close every window.
If you keep any of that, I should say, listeners, the bee's gone.
So you were telling us about the show,
David. It's a show about my mum and dad. It's a series of stories, really, about my mum's affair, about what that meant in terms of how we were brought up and the fanaticism about golf, and then related to how my dad has dementia, whatever. But there's a kind of manifesto in it, partly, again, about truth, about just telling your own truth or whatever. But also, it begins with 10 minutes of stuff about social media and offence, really, about how people get incredibly offended about comedy now, primarily. And the sort of motivation for that is, okay, here are people getting mad. I mean, like, it's comedy, so I choose the most extreme examples of people managing to get angry about stuff that I've said on Twitter. But I'm sort of saying, I'm now going to do stuff that is probably, in some ways, very offensive about my mother's affair and about dementia and whatever. But these are my people. This is my family. So I'm sort of challenging the audience to get offended. Saying, like, if I'm not offended, by talking about my mother's infidelity or about my father's dementia, then who are you to get offended?
See, what you're talking about is causing offence publicly. Sending to your family. Mm. So how did you navigate that? How did you even approach that when it came to explaining to your family what the contents of the show were?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, the primary thing was my brother's. Because I in terms of my mum, she's dead. And I think the show, in a way, is, I think I say this in the show, is a kind of anti-funeral speech, because one of the things I talk about is that when people die at their funerals, all people ever say about them is that they were wonderful. That tends to be the basic keynote fucking thing of a funeral speech. And and when that was happening, and my mum, I was thinking, like, well, you didn't know what she was like. You know, 30 years of her life were based on golf, which was based on an affair, and it's being missed out, right? And it's the truth thing again, but it's got a thing going on which isn't just about truth. It's about, like, it's a real tragedy to see someone whose life was colourful and weird and crazy and, you know, did all sorts of stuff that isn't normal, was idiosyncratic, get wiped out in this erasure of, like, niceness. Mm. You know, that's like, that doesn't say who she was anymore. And I think it's important, if anything, if you're going to try and remember someone, that you remember them how they actually were.
Yeah, I remember
them. You know, that's why it's also about dementia and whatever. So anyway, that's my idea. It's difficult that before you do the show, that's actually how it's going to come across. And that was the thing with my brothers. I was actually filming in China at the time for Discovery. And I sent both my brothers an email saying, I'm thinking about doing this show. My younger brother, who was a taxi driver in New York and quite hard, just said, you're not doing this. Just one, you're not doing this. And I thought, oh, fuck. Right? And I ended up saying to both of them, it's really, really hard. My older brother said, he's a bit more reasonable, said, look, I've got lots of worries about this, but tell me, are you going to do it? Is it even worth me? And I said, you know what? I am going to do it.
Right.
He knew
he couldn't stop you.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
What do they think of the show?
Well, that was the thing. Is I ended up just saying, look, you've got to trust me here. Right. I know it's about our mother. I know she's only just died. I know it's about our dad. He's got dementia. Just trust me here. Yeah. And the show is, you know, it's really funny. I know this because it gets loads of laughs. So there is laughter, but laughter, in my opinion, doesn't mean that you're necessarily being mean or horrible about something. Laughter can be many things. And I think at the end of the show, what you get is this very deep sense that you know who these people were, even though I've talked about them in entirely kind of like, they were mental, they did this fucking crazy shit.
No, I've seen the show.
This is what I was going to say. Uzo's being incredibly polite here.
I've seen the show. No, because Reg said to me, you've got to see the show.
Right.
So I went to see the show and I took a friend of mine because my friend's down. She's down because her sister just died.
Right.
I didn't know what your show was about.
Right.
So I said to Reg, I sent him a text. And I said, Reg, hey, I'm going to take... Because I don't read, you know, I watch trailers. I don't want to know what something's about.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
Like, I don't do research, but I'm going to experience something. So I just said, look, I just want to double check something. I'm taking a friend who's in a bit of a sensitive situation on a date, you know, to make her feel better. What's this show about? And he was like, I was like, wow, this is going to one of two ways.
Yeah.
And it was incredible.
Thank you.
It was, for me, it was incredible. For her, it was incredible.
How did she react?
We had moments together. Mm. We were sitting pretty much in the front row.
Right.
And we had moments that it was really, she let it out, crying, you know, but it was just moments that we were both crying, laughing. Do you know what I mean? I thought it was the most incredible healing process for me as well, you know. So, and I mean, it was incredible.
Thank you very much. But that's really interesting because I didn't set out to do something that necessarily will have that healing effect. That would seem to be like a social worker's job, right? But or a psychologist's job or whatever. But I have noticed that a side effect of that show does seem
Absolutely.
To be that.
Yeah.
I mean, one, I've stopped doing it now. I might bring it back, but I used to do a Q&A at the end of the show. Did you see it with a Q&A? Or had I dropped it?
I saw it with a
Q&A. Yeah, I dropped the Q&A just because I kept on getting the same questions.
Right,
and I thought, I want to keep it fresh, so I'm going to move it along. And I wrote some new material instead. But when I had the Q&A, a couple of times people would just stand up and tell me about their dead mum or whatever, or the fact that they had a really bad relationship with their uncle or whatever. One bloke stood up and said, I've come to see the show 4 times. And I said, why? This sounds very self-aggrandizing, excuse me, but this is true. So he said, I've come to see the show 4 times. He said, I live with my mum and she's had a stroke and I come here to feel alive, he said. And I just thought, wow, that does make me feel like I'm doing something valuable.
Has the show, because I suppose you're still doing it, has the show changed your relationship with grief, do you think, and the grieving process since you lost your mother?
Yeah, I think it has. I mean, I think probably it started as part of my grieving process. Because my mum died very suddenly. Yeah, writing it. My mum died very suddenly, and my mum, I had a complicated relationship with my mum, like most people do, in truth. And suddenly that's all taken away, isn't it? You know, you can't sort of sort that out. I mean, I don't know whoever sorts out that shit. But, you know, she just went. then as well, suddenly, me and my brother are in charge of my dad because he's got dementia and she was his primary carer. So that's a sudden growing up. I mean, I know we're not young, but it feels unbelievably grown up to suddenly be in charge of someone with dementia. You haven't really, who's your dad? Who you haven't really thought about it. And who, by the way, we had to tell that my mum had died over and over and over again. So like suddenly you're in a particularly dark, weird place with all that. So yeah, I think for me, comedy is always, and this sounds incredibly, again, sort of like pretentious in a way, but it is true. It's like a resource. Mm. It's like, okay, what can I do to make this situation, which is a very bad one, feel in any way manageable emotionally? And for me, it's to start writing about it and to tell stories about those people.
Yeah. You know. And your brothers, how did they respond?
Well, yeah, well, my older brother, because my younger brother lives in New York, but my older brother's around, lives in Crouch End. He could definitely come. And I said, come to the workshops. And if you really don't like something, I'll take it out.
Right.
But he didn't come because I think he was avoiding it. I think he just thought, I won't be able to deal with it.
Right.
So then he comes to the opening night of the first time I did it at a place called the Chocolate Factory in Borough Market. Do you know that place?
I'm sorry, I just straight away thought Chocolate City, which is a black club night.
Yeah,
which I'm pretty sure it's where
I did it there as well. Obviously,
makes sense.
It's a bit of a different show. No, the Chocolate Factory was actually a place that they made chocolate, I think. It's in Borough Market.
Yeah, I know it.
So I did it there, and he comes to the opening night, and there's loads of critics in the room and all these kind of important people or whatever. But I was only really worried about what my brother thought. I was genuinely thought, oh, fuck, this will be terrible if he's, you know, doesn't like it. So in the Q&A then, there's all these people with their hands up, including like the critic from The Guardian, blah, blah, blah. And I said, sorry, everybody, I've just got to find out first of all what my older brother thought.
Amazing.
And he said, I loved it. But then he said, and it made me cry on stage, I loved it because it felt like she was in the room. My mother, right? And that, I guess, was what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say, look, this woman had all sorts of shit going on. She's a strange and mad person. But let's remember her actually how she was. And that idea, maybe that's what you're actually doing in writing a show like that, is she goes away suddenly, you keep her alive because she's actually in the room.
In her authenticity, in her truth, good, bad, and different as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting. How do you sort of, in fact, I suppose I could probably put this to you, Owen, as someone who writes, your songwriter, and you know, you've been an artist for years yourself, and now you work with lots of different artists. How do you sort of juggle that thing of putting your life into your work and knowing that what you write as a song might affect the people that you love? For instance, if you write a song about your wife or arguing with your wife, or even now, if you write a song about an ex-girlfriend, how are you able to juggle your art with the real world consequences?
Well, I don't really write for myself anymore. So that kind of like clears that one up. But the thing with songwriting, I think, and any kind of writing, is that sometimes the kind of cathartic part of it is slipping things in there that people do, it's not obvious what you're talking about.
So you'll hide it behind some sort of,
you kind
poetic...
of like, I don't know, I mean, I don't really know why, but you kind of like, I wrote a song recently with someone who wanted to talk about their grandmother who was ill, you know, which doesn't really make a very good song, you know. It's like, you can't talk directly about that in the chorus, you know what I mean? Like,
although I love those kind of songs.
I mean, yeah, I mean, there is a market, but not a mass one. So you kind of like...
Wait, did you write the song in the end? And how does it go?
What's it called?
It's called My Nan.
Yeah. It's called, My Nan's Not Well.
It's called Nan Fell Down the Stairs.
Again.
But I mean, I guess it comes from trying to be quite clever about it, and quite all the songs and music that I'm into and I love, I sometimes get really kind of obsessed with artists, or mainly from the past, and then you find out that a song that you've loved for years is actually about something else. And you're just like, and then you listen to it again for the first time.
That's like, I think it was you that told me about a Labyrinth song, Jealous, right? So Labyrinth's got this beautiful song called Jealous, which sounds like a love song.
The whole
chorus is, I'm jealous of you, I'm jealous of your family, blah, 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 I'm jealous of all the things that you now have. It's actually about his dad, and about his dad moving on and starting a new family. And he's jealous of the kids having their dad around. And that level of honesty is beautiful. But again, it's what you said about sort of
hiding it.
Right.
Yeah. Also, The Drugs Don't Work by The Verve, I think, anyway, is about his friend that was dying of cancer.
Oh, it's right. So it's not about recreational drugs.
Yeah.
Oh, really? That's really
drugs
interesting.
Aren't working.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I really didn't know that.
But people want songs to be what they feel they should be. Like, I always, I used to listen, and this is not a cool reference, to Steve Wright's Sunday love songs, right? Every Sunday.
That's cool, man.
I know it's cool.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. I know. But, In my defense, I was taking my son to his martial arts class every Sunday.
Don't blame it on you.
Yeah, it's like that's not okay. Because okay, actually, he always wanted to change the station. I said, no, we've got to listen to this. Anyway, every fucking Sunday, right? And I know why he's doing it, because of the, but he would play Easy, right? By the Commodores, right? Yeah. He'd play Easy like Sunday morning. And I'd always think, this is the opposite of a love song. This is a song about a bloke who's in a relationship, desperately wants to get out of it, has just managed to get out of it,
yeah,
and now feels free because he's single, you know, and he's liberated. That's what that song is. But every Sunday, Steve writes Sunday love songs, it was there. And I just think people wanted to hear it, yeah, in that way.
How have your, speak about your son, how have your kids changed your work?
Have they changed my work? I mean, they've changed my life in exactly the way that Owen was talking about earlier, that they, you know, there's no question that I didn't realise until I had children that there is a way of actually living your life through someone else's perspective. I think I was always like, okay, I know who I am and I'm quite, you know, convinced that this is the way of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. All right, and then suddenly, in a very kind of big psychic shift, you think, oh no, now I'm really thinking about how it looks like through their eyes. And I have to keep that in my mind sort of all the time. And yeah, and I never really did that, I think, before. It gives you a type of empathy that is very physical, isn't it, yeah, I think. In terms of my work, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say, really. I mean, I write children's books. Well, so that's partly to do with them. Certainly.
Yeah, you told me a fantastic story on the side of a road in Uganda at, yeah, some weird Coca-Cola shack.
Yeah.
You told me a story about how your son
made the same time that you did the joke about your penis, was it? Because that was a great... Oh, no. That was a fucking brilliant moment for me.
You'll probably tell it better than I can. If you remember it, I'll let you...
I feel like the penis story is better.
Yeah, the penis story, I'm giving you the floor to tell the story.
Well, I've got to try and remember it. And it involves a South African being racist, I think. Because what I think happened was we were... at the equator.
We were actually at the equator.
There's a big sign saying the equator. Basically, it's a globe. I remember because Michaela Cole did a lot of weird physics about how the world is like an egg. Let's go into that another time. Anyway.
we need an hour to explain
Michaela's theories about how the world works. But anyway, so there's a shack there for pissing, right? And we were in it at one point together.
Yep.
And you made a joke essentially along the lines of wanting to go in on your own because you were worried someone might look over and you would fail to live up to the stereotype of the black man. Is that right?
That's pretty much the joke.
Yeah.
It was subversive. Yeah. No, it was interesting.
It was actually. It was all those things. I thought, that's a good joke. And as someone who has often been standing at a urinal and been slightly worried that he's not matching up and therefore not having a shy bladder, I thought, great, good joke. But we had these security blokes with us there who were also African, right? And they were all white and they were all like slightly dodgy, I thought.
Just a bit, yeah.
And on hearing that joke, a bloke told us that joke. What is the joke? It's some joke that I've heard for years about a black guy who has tattooed on his penis something like...
Oh, was it like a money thing or something?
No, it's a saying.
Oh, yeah,
gets longer.
All right, okay. Right,
and I can't even remember what it is. This is me failing as a comedian, but I think it's a good fail because it means I haven't memorised a racist joke.
Yeah.
Basically, it's about a black guy who you think he's only got hello on his penis, but it's later on,
hello, welcome
it says
to...
hello and welcome to blah,
actually,
blah, blah.
Hold on, let me show you what it says.
And we sat, and we had to stand there, both me and you,
while he told us this joke.
Yeah, yeah. And it went on for quite a long time. I mean, just the idea, even if Reggie Anderson have said his subversive, modern, postmodern jokes, the idea that he'd think, I'll tell this bloke and this black bloke, I'll tell the two of them my joke about a black man's cock. It's just incredible.
What is the thought process that gets you to the point where it's like, yeah, go on, tell him.
I don't think there is one.
Yeah.
I genuinely don't think there is one.
How did you deal with that?
I want to know how you deal with that.
My memory is terrible. What I do remember is we shared a look. And that's what I loved, the look afterwards.
And then just both walked off in different directions. It was fucking comically brilliant.
Yeah.
The sort of aftermath of it. I remember just looking at you and then bang, we're out of here.
Because we had quite a nice moment. I mean, it was weird. We were having a joke. We had our willies and irons. Yeah. We had a giggle.
Yeah.
We shook and packed away the goods and we were off on our way. And then we got stopped.
Then we got stopped.
And then it got
racist. Then we got pulled back to 1973. That's what happened. There we were in 2017 and we got pulled back. Yeah. By a South African to 1973.
Of all people.
Side question. Why would you have been concerned if it was warm outside?
We should move on. Yeah. It's taking us back to that weird shack. But you were telling me a story about your boy and something he said to you, which ended up inspiring. Yes, which ended up inspiring a book, which has now gone on to be so much more, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I started writing kids' books, which I didn't really want to be a children's author. I think one of the things about, I don't know about any job, I guess, but particularly if you're in a creative job, is that people think, I think, that you do stuff for reasons to do with your career or whatever. You know, oh, like people saw that David Williams had written children's books, so I tried to write children's books. No, I did something because an idea came my way. And the idea was, my son was talking to me, at the time he was about 8, and he said to me about Harry Potter. Why doesn't Harry run away from the Dursleys and try and find some better parents? And I actually know the answer to that. The answer to that is that's because J.K. Rowling wants Harry's life when he's away from Hogwarts to be as horrible as possible,
right,
so that Hogwarts feels like a magical escape. But I didn't say that. I said, that's given me an idea. And the idea was a world in which children can choose their own parents. And I decided I'm going to write that. And because I don't really understand the idea that there are boundaries between storytelling. So if you've done, like, I don't know, adult one-man shows or novels or whatever, you can't write children's literature. I don't agree with that. I just think if I can write, I can write children's books. I just have to change the address a little bit. So I wrote it as a children's book. And it's now sold 500,000 copies, and I'm writing a movie of it now. Wow. So, and Ezra's got an iPod out of it.
that's good parenting.
That is good parenting.
That's really good parenting. Yeah. So is he sort of walking around claiming responsibility for the
book? No, because Ezra is much too cool for me. He's 12 now, and he basically disavows most of his, relationship with me. I mean, I'm the butt of every single one of his jokes. And the other thing that Ezra does is he seems to know quite a lot about my career. I think he's probably looked at, and he chooses the most embarrassing stuff I've ever done to basically talk about all the time. So I think it's a terribly good thing, but I did an appeal on behalf of an incontinence charity, right? On Radio 4. They're called Eric. They're a very, very good charity. And they wrote to me and they said, no one else will do this. Would you do it? And I said, yeah, I'll do it. So as a result of that, there's a photo of me somewhere online holding the incontinence charity toys, which are called Wee and Poo, and which are a yellow triangle. It's real.
That's real.
This is real. It's real. Honestly, yellow triangle with eyes and a brown triangle with eyes. They're called Wee and Poo. I'm holding them up and I'm smiling. Look, I'm slightly dying inside. And Ezra has talked about writing a Wikipedia thing for me, in which he mentions that as my primary achievement.
Ezra's dark.
Yeah.
He must be proud of him.
What's the name of the charity?
Eric.
Why is it called
Eric? Yeah.
I should know this as their official spokesman. I think I is definitely for incontinence.
Eric.
I know, isn't it great? We shouldn't be laughing, but
I can see Eric in my head.
Have you found it? Well, no, I'll find it for you.
There's lots of pictures of a black guy with a dicky bow, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, really? That's not me, I don't think. Yeah, right. The Children's Continence Charity. Okay, there we go. There I am, holding up Wee and Poo.
All right, I should probably describe the
Ezra
picture.
Told me that they are actually, those two toys are on a list of worst toys on the internet.
Okay, the picture that we're looking at right now is David holding two cuddly toys, I think.
Yeah, cuddly, sort of.
Maybe beanbag type toys with small soft balls inside.
How much cuddling they get.
No, one looks like the poo emoji.
Yeah.
And the other is just a yellow triangle with arms and feet.
Yeah.
And that's to represent we.
Yeah,
is it supposed to be like a teardrop?
You know what? I wasn't involved in the design.
Wee and Poo. Do you reckon, were your little boy like those?
He loved them. He doesn't think got a clue.
I've got some at home. I've got, if you want, I can send on Wee and Poo.
Please.
Right, or you could just write directly to Eric. I should say, I'm going to say this because I think you should include this bit because it's funny, but I should say, Eric, it's a really good charity. Reggie, you're not going to be able to include this unless you don't laugh during me saying this, all right? It's a really good charity for children who are incontinent. Stop laughing.
But there's nothing that's not funny about that charity.
I'm sorry.
It's a good cause.
I've done my best.
Well, look, this is a platform where we're promoting it. So technically, even though we are laughing, we're doing a good thing.
Reggie doesn't give a damn. He doesn't even have toilets in his house. He officially doesn't give a damn about incontinence. He's giving us bottles of water and no toilets. He doesn't give a damn about Eric.
It's a trick by whoever the villain is in Eric's universe. That's him. It's a trick.
Oh, my God. All right, on that bombshell, we should take a handbrake turn. I imagine we'll whack a sting in there and we'll change subjects. So we'll move on.
Play a little Cheeks tune of bass in it.
Yeah. It's Seinfeld.
It pretty much is. Yeah. From incontinence to identity. I think that's the only way to segue that. Yeah. I don't quite know how we're going to do it apart from using music. Listen, David, we've spoken quite a bit about your show, but the thing that I took from it, as well as I'm sure a lot of other people, was bravery is maybe not the right word, but I considered it quite brave.
Yeah, sure, thank you.
With how much self-evaluation you were able to do in it.
Yeah.
But in that sort of self-evaluation, and how thorough it was during the show, how tied to the stereotype of the good Jewish boy do you think you were growing up?
I don't know. Growing up, I was quite a bit, I think. I mean, I didn't come from a conventional Jewish family.
We've seen the show.
It's not a conventional family. No, but I think that is one reason I did it in a way, in that I think that one of the things about the stereotype of being Jewish is that people imagine, oh, right, his father's probably an accountant and they're probably quite bohemian. They probably lived in this big house in North London. No, my dad, you know, was made redundant he was a chemist, made redundant. Then he worked in an antique market. And my mum, as we know, was just like having an affair and therefore selling golf memorabilia. So it's neither one thing nor the other. It's not like, you know, it's not like a very deprived childhood, but nor is it that sort of like I imagine, say, Emma Freud's childhood or whatever. So I went to an Orthodox Jewish primary school, not because my parents were religious, but because it was the only school, as you will know, in the sort of area where you wouldn't get knifed. Certainly in the 70s, it was like incredibly rough around there.
Yeah.
So the Jewish school, I went there, which meant that I went to school wearing a yarmulke and actually these things called tzitzit, which are like Mormon vests. I wore those every day. We learnt Hebrew, all that stuff. And it's weird when I think of it now. And I think when I first came out of there, I didn't really know anyone who wasn't Jewish, which is quite hard in London because there's only about 250,000 Jews in Britain. But I didn't really know anyone. So I did have quite a cloistered upbringing in a way. But I don't know if I was living up to the stereotype or not, really. I think now it's a weird thing because, as you know, I'm an atheist and all sorts of things. But I've become more owning of my own Jewish identity. I mean, then it's hard to know, you know, because that's just what I lived in. Mm. But since I've been away, you know, now I'm not married to someone Jewish. I don't have any belief or whatever in it as a religion. But the identity has become sort of more important to me, you know, because I don't know. I just think as you get older and as you sort out stuff like your family and as I become more aware of what it meant that my grandparents were refugees from the Nazis, it all feels more present to me like it did. You know, you're part of the dance as you get older. You're part of this history.
Yeah.
And it really is important, particularly because stuff that I didn't think would ever happen again is sort of happening again.
Yeah.
You know,
it's really funny when you talk about your relationship with the culture and the religion itself, because I literally had zero connection to the Jewish community until my sister started to go to a secondary school in North London. But years and years ago, when my sister was at the school, next door was Jewish Free School.
Yeah.
And so that was the first time that, because, you know, I didn't really venture into Stamford Hill, which was the closest sort of Orthodox community to me and where I grew up.
Yeah.
I saw lots of Jewish families and lots of young Jewish kids. And then, Owen, you'll know this, in my early 20s, I became friends with a group of Jewish girls.
Mm. And when you say friends?
No, not like that. There's like 10 of them. And I haven't got that kind of sort of energy. we'll go with my word. Energy over stamina. Yeah. Even I haven't got that. But we're still really good friends now. And you've actually married a Jewish woman.
I have.
And you've come from a non-Jewish background. So that culture for me was just a massive shock and a massive sort of sideswipe in terms of just how different it was to everything I experienced growing up, but also in a weird way, how similar it was to West African culture. But that's another thing we'll get to. But for you as a man who's married into that culture and whose wife is Jewish, which technically makes your son Jewish because he it's through Jewish. The mother,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
the mother's line. How have you sort of navigated that culture and that change?
Well, I mean, it wasn't really present when I was growing up. I have one of my best friends is Jewish, but he's American. They're very liberal Jews and it wasn't a thing as such. And so my family are very kind of liberal left. They're actors and teachers, and religion was never a thing in my household. We sometimes went to midnight mass, but just because it was fun. And then, I met a Jewish girl and I kind of like got a window into this, like,
it's another world.
It's a completely another world.
Where's she from?
She's from Leeds.
Oh, from Leeds, right. It's quite a big Jewish community in Leeds. Yeah, I mean, Leeds. I say big. There's no big Jewish communities anywhere, you know, compared to any other ethnic minorities. It's a very small community. Yeah. I think people think it's much bigger than it is, but it really isn't. But, yeah, Leeds, there is one. I've actually done a gig at Leeds Synagogue.
Have you?
She might have even been there.
Maybe she will. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah.
Is your wife religious?
No.
Okay.
So she's... Here's the thing with Judaism, which I've come to love, is that it's actually my wife... appreciates the traditions and the days and the fact that it's a get-together and it's, you know, she doesn't believe in God, but she likes the fact that there's Yom Kippur and there's all these different things. And like you were saying, like you're a part of the dance, which is...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was talking about this on stage once. Early on in the show, I talk about being an atheist. I talk about it in context about getting anti-Semitic tweets. And I said, so some of this is a bit weird because I am a fundamentalist atheist, but I'm also very out about being Jewish. And then I say, that's a condition only available to Jews, by the way. Because a lot of people don't understand that. And I still get people on Twitter saying, right to me saying, you say you're an atheist, but you're, my biography on Twitter is Jew. That's it. Right. And people don't understand that. And I partly keep it there for all those people who occasionally write to me saying, I don't understand it. So, right, how can you be an atheist? Right. But the truth is that it's a condition of being.
Yeah.
And actually, it's very little to do with, for me, even with like things like Yom Kippur. It was Yom Kippur the other day and I hardly knew about it.
Yeah.
It's just to do with a sort of attitude and a culture and all the rest of it. And anyway, so I was on stage and I was talking, someone asked me about that. Someone non-Jewish said to me, I still don't understand this stuff about you being atheist and a Jew. And it turned out there's a rabbi in the audience, right? And I said, you understand, don't you? And the rabbi said, yeah, I'm an atheist. It's a rabbi, right?
Wow.
Right? But lots of rabbis are basically atheists. Judaism, as far as I can make out, there's no afterlife in Judaism, right? It's just a sort of weird, kind of often vaguely numerological belief system. It's kind of basically OCD. Been made into a religion. There are 600. It is. There are 600.
I dare you to say that to your wife.
That's so accurate.
It is. Right.
Say it to my mother-in-law. Yeah.
You know, because Jews are meant to, like, you know, on Shabbat, which is Friday to Saturday, you're not meant to turn lights on. You're not meant to carry stuff. You know, it's all that. There are 613 mitzvot, meaning good things that you're meant to do. 613. What kind of number is that? It's not even a round number. Too many and not even a round number. Right? So I just think it's a weird way of organizing your thoughts that some people are into, some people are not, but I'm not sure it's properly a religion.
So if your son's Jewish, Owen, are you raising him as a, you know, and your wife's very liberal, I know Mouse very well.
Yeah.
Do you raise your child as a young Jewish man? I mean,
well, here's the thing. I mean, if the thing is, my wife focuses on the traditions of being Jewish, right?
Right.
And I feel that my family's traditions are just as important. So it might not fall under the umbrella of a religion or a name, but we still do things as a family that I find comforting because they're traditional.
Right. Mm.
So, yeah, he's going to be raised as Jewish, and as you know, you were there the day he was circumcised.
I really was.
Were you?
Yeah, he was.
Tell us more about that.
Do you know what? I was freaking out.
Did you know he was going to be circumcised?
Reg wasn't circumcised that day. As well.
I did that myself with some turn-up. That was a long day.
But he said...
Well I've been next to him at a urinal, and I can say that he could have done with that extra 2%.
I was freaking out, wasn't right. I?
Yeah,
I was
you were all over.
I was like, this is not in my kind of realm of stuff. You know what I mean? Like, what are you doing? And Reggie was like, who's doing it? And I was like, obviously the rabbi's doing it.
It's actually called a moil.
Yeah, a moil is doing it. And Reggie was like, I was like, surely we should be in hospital, guys. Surely we should be like, this should be a bit more kind of like clinical. And Reggie was like, no way, man. Like all West African boys get the rabbi to do it or the moil to do it.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, completely.
I was like, really?
All right.
Believe it or not, that wasn't the first time I've been in that situation. It's like the fifth or sixth time I've been in somebody's house.
This week.
But it gave you so much.
Yeah.
Legally, or did they know?
I just follow around rabbis. I follow around rabbis around Peckham and just follow them into people's houses.
That they might be doing.
It might be a little Nigerian or Ghanaian boy getting the snip.
No, but it made me feel so much more comfortable because you were like, obviously you get them to do it because they do it all the time.
Yeah, right.
Well, interesting enough, my son is circumcised, but not by Moyle. My son wasn't circumcised when he was born. My wife is Catholic, and as a fundamentalist atheist, I sort of felt a bit weird about it, because I thought, right. I thought, well, if he wants to be Jewish later on in life, if he wants to be Jewish so much that he feels a bit weird about having a foreskin, which you might do if you feel your identity is that, it's going to be a pain in the ass for him to have this operation when he's 27. Do you know what I mean?
Completely.
But I left it.
Well, not pain in the ass, but...
Yeah, pain in the penis. But then amazingly, and I don't believe in God, but this is quite a good argument for God, he had to have one medically when he was about four or five because he was having trouble urinating. His foreskin was too tight, in fact.
Wow.
And then, cause, actually, part of the problem was that he got his penis... Sorry about it, everyone.
He's going to love this.
He got his penis caught in a zip when he was about sort of, quite young, in a zip of his onesie, right?
You're getting it back for the Eric story here.
Wait, hang on.
It was caught in the zip of a onesie.
Was it an animal onesie?
I think it was a lion onesie. Yeah. So... It would have looked all right. Yeah. Anyway, here's the thing that actually happened. Right? This is what happened, right? He was in quite a lot of pain, and Morwenna, my wife, said to me, "Like, we don't know what to do. Should we take him to hospital?" She said, "Google it." I said, "I can't." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I'm a British celebrity over the age of 45. I cannot Google the words child's penis. All right, I may as well just phone up Operation Yew Tree and add myself in." Right. So, yeah, but soon after that, we thought this is no good. It's something he needs doing. So he had it done medically in a hospital. And at some level, weird level, I'm quite pleased he's got circumcised now.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is, but part of me.
It's really interesting, isn't it, that relationship between the Jewish community and the black community. I mean, from one standpoint, obviously the circumcision thing that, I've witnessed a million and one times, not through choice, but I'm sure Uzo, you can attest to this, and maybe even yourself, David, that there's always been that weird sort of comparison and likeness between the two communities. Where do you think that stems from, and what is that down to?
Well, one thing I think is, and this is really, I'm interested what you think about this, is people who are not Jewish and white sometimes say, when I talk about racism towards Jews on Twitter or whatever, the people on Twitter are so stupid, whatever, but they start saying to me, start telling me, no, but Jews are not a race. They're not a race. Right. It's a religion, not a race or whatever. And I say, no, you misunderstand what racism is. Racism only exists really as a concept because of the racists. Right, that we could do without racism, but we have to have this concept because there are racists. Right now, I am an atheist. I don't believe in the religion, but I would be shot by the Gestapo tomorrow. Mm. Like, not even tomorrow. If they came in now, I'm the one they'd shoot. They wouldn't be too keen on you two either, but Owen would be fine, right? Except
with his blonde hair.
Yeah, with his blonde hair.
This guy.
Totally Aryan. They'd be unhappy about his wife, right? But everything else would be fine. Yeah. So my point is that if the religion is irrelevant, I am being shot for my race. What else am I being shot by? So therefore... Mm. I have to identify my Jewishness as race because, unfortunately, that's what the racists think of it is. And I think that sense of, the fact that you have to be aware of racism is what would bind the Jewish community and the black community. I mean, it did in civil rights in America for a long time.
Completely, completely. There were rabbis that marched with Dr. King. And, and also, what's your sort of take on that? Because growing up in London, obviously, it's an incredibly multicultural city. It always has been. Mm. Have you ever seen that similarity or ever... experienced it even?
The similarity, well, what my friends are Jewish will tell a Jewish joke, and I'm like, that's a great joke, I can't repeat that joke,
right?
But if I change the joke to like a Nigerian mum, it's exactly the same joke, and it lands and it works because the similarities are just, they're just there, they're always there, because I think it's the culture is the same, but everyone thinks their culture is different and independent, but when you talk to someone else, you go, it's actually, they're all the same.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's true. I mean, one of the reasons I do talk about being Jewish more than I used to is that I think that identity has become like a massive deal for any ethnic minority. And I think that Jews slightly find it, especially in Britain, find it difficult to know what their identity is. Mm. And actually, it is actually... Because in America... they sort of like landed in a really big way, and they had all these iconic people, comedians, people like Lenny Bruce and Groucho Marx.
That's helped
Woody
define
Allen.
It, right? In a new context.
Exactly. And particularly in New York, where there are actually lots of Jews, properly, there are loads of them there. They had a sort of voice and a culture that was, but here, it's always been a bit more sort of quiet. And someone once said to me about the Jewish Chronicle, which is the Jewish newspaper, that they have a headline, right? And it's, they hate us is the headline, right? So it's always about anti-Semitism. And I said, no, no, it's they hate us and let's not make a fuss about it, right? So that's the English, the Anglo-Jewish thing. And as a result, it's always been rather invisible and whatever. And I think, no, we should try and find out what that identity is. And you know, in the same way that, you know, we'd lot to learn from the black community there, because the black community, anywhere they've been really, have managed to say that this is our identity, you know, this is our stuff, we're going to talk about it. But I think in Britain, Jews have always been a bit like, oh, we don't want people to know that we're Jewish. And I always want, just the truth part of me reacts against that.
Mm. Well, look, we should probably wrap it up there because it is an incredibly difficult and complicated conversation.
Can we go
to
back
have.
To Eric?
I like the chance of, like, I like talking about Wee and Pooh, the toys that you can purchase. That was that, and looking at the picture was actually quite great too.
Yeah, no, it's a fabulous picture. If anyone wants to go online, it's me with Wee and Pooh, Eric.
It's a fabulous picture.
Yeah, it's a fabulous picture. I think I'm smiling more in some of them.
We've spent a huge chunk of this episode talking about your show, and I think it would be rude not to tell people where they can see it and how they can be a part of it. No. I genuinely mean it. This isn't me doing the cheesy plug thing, kind of is, but I actually endorse this.
I
love what you've done with the show.
Thank you. It's called My Family Not the Sitcom, and it is touring in the UK from next February. I'll be doing everywhere, basically, in Britain. I think it's like a 60-day tour, which I haven't done. I haven't done that type of tour for years and years, so I'll be quite tired. But hopefully, you know, a lot of people, when it was starting to be a bit of a thing and people were talking about it a lot, I got a lot of people on Twitter or whatever saying, but this isn't fair, it's clearly a good show and I live in Edinburgh or whatever. So I thought, yeah, that isn't fair. You shouldn't just do stuff for people in London. How much I love London. So we're touring from next February.
So basically what David hasn't said to you is that don't see it at the end of the run because you'll be knackered and the show will probably be rubbish towards the end of the run. So you've been warned, get in early. That's the best way to do it.
Unless I take a lot of drugs, amphetamines and stuff. So if you've got any of those, come up to me towards the end of the tour and give them to me. It's all right to say that, isn't it?
But it's absolutely fine. Well, on that bombshell, Owen, aka GQ Man of the Year. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're
in
welcome.
My ramshackle falling apart, not quite there library.
I've slightly fallen in love with it.
It's kind of working now, isn't it? It feels kind of cool. Uzo, the Black Milk Tray Man, thank you for being here, sir.
Pleasure.
Nice. And David, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you, Reggie. And it's going to be brilliant when it's finished.
Yeah, yeah.
Your house, I mean, not the podcast. Not the podcast.
But I really wanted to go.
Once we really cut all the shit out, it's going to be brilliant.
All right, we'll see you next time for more Talk Stew.
Originals.